Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode one of the Dissident Film Club. My name is Keaton Weiss, here with my co-host for this new venture, my good friend of now, I believe, 17 years, Mr. Justin Van Voris.
It's been a long ride.
Yeah, I think I've now known you most of my life, because I'm 33 going on 34, and we got to know each other in 2004, 2003, something like that.
It would be January 2004.
Oh, really?
Which is interesting. So considering, and this is one of the things that, so I was the pseudo best man at Keaton's wedding. It was like one of these situations where like I was the best man, but they didn't want to say I was the best man because I don't know, maybe some people's feelings get hurt. I don't know. I didn't pry.
I had to walk a very fine emotional tightrope in selecting my groomsmen. That was enough. I couldn't really afford to get into who the best man was.
Yeah, the real pick of the litter there.
It was a very political process. And so, you know, I couldn't then go further and actually pick a formal best man.
I mean, I don't know what else the best man does besides make a speech, but throw the bachelor party. I don't know. But anyways, I just did the speech. One of the things that I regrettably did not mention, or this would have been in this, you know, give you some ideas, is that when we first started hanging out, we would make lists of movies that we like a top 10, like horror films. And we would just go, that's how we would socialize. We would just go to a pizza place, we'd get a couple slices of pizza, and we would just write down lists of movies that we liked, like top 10 horror films, top 10 Scorsese. And we would just go down the list of what we liked. And that's something I forgot. I should have mentioned that in the best man speech. And then it would have been nice if I mentioned like top 10 Keaton moments.
Yeah.
During the friendship. That would have been a good idea. Very mournful for the fact that I didn't do that. But that brings us to what would...
I'm mournful of the fact that we didn't have a tape recorder with us, because we could have gotten into the podcast game early if we just recorded
conversations. We could have started.
We're basically doing the same thing now.
Right. Of course, I don't know. It wasn't as easy to upload such things on the internet back in those days. In fact, that's like pre-YouTube, like, right?
I mean, YouTube may have been around, but it was nothing like what it is now.
I know. I don't even know. On YouTube. Right, exactly. And I think on YouTube, probably at that point, you could not put up any video that was like over 3 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, I know for a while there was a strict 10-minute cutoff. Yeah. And
right.
So now we'll
right.
have a YouTube channel for this, and we will also have an RSS feed. I'm going to post this first episode on our Do Dissidents podcast, since this is sort of a spin-off sister podcast, just to get the word out about it. And then moving forward, this will be on its own feed.
You kind of have a whole network now of dissident themed podcasts. So now we have the dissident movies, and you know, what is the next dissident theme podcast you're gonna do?
Maybe the Dissident Kitchen, where we do a cooking show.
Right, and you just get like chefs on or recipes, and just be like, "What recipe just is a real like fuck you to the general public?"
Yeah.
You know,
or you could just rant about politics like while the water's boiling. Like when cooking, you have a period of like a little bit of dead time. You know,
right? Yeah,
where you
exactly.
Can just kind of talk about different things. So maybe that'll be. I don't know. I have to find a chef for that. Anyway, our co-host on the Do Dissidents podcast, Russell, started giving movie recommendations at the end of all of our Do Dissidents episodes, and that's what kind of gave me the idea. And Russell's a great film buff, too, so he'll be, you know, coming on the show as a sort of recurring guest, and he'll probably end up being like a three-way co-host kind of thing. We actually did a movie podcast with our friend a few years back. I think that was 2016, 2017, where a mutual friend of ours really got us into the whole podcast thing, because he started one, and you and him started, and then I guested on one, and then I just kind of joined, and that was a lot of fun. I loved that one. Now, you're a filmmaker. We got to know each other, obviously. We were in acting class. You sat at our lunch table, you know, so we got to know each other kind of through there. But we've done a lot of film projects as a team, and one of the things that I've been saying to you over the past year or so, and thinking we should do our own sort of podcast project is because, you know, you spend so much time and so much effort and all this ball breaking, making your own films, writing scripts, trying to get films made. And I have been trying to stress to you how much easier this is.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, isn't this a pleasure compared to that? You turn a microphone on, you go on Zoom, you log on the internet, you record on your screen, boom, done.
Right. Right. Why make a movie when you could just talk about it? No, I've been very reticent about the whole podcast thing. First of all, the idea of it, you know, not to offend anybody else, and kind of for lack of sounding hypocritical, given the fact that I have one now, but I've always found podcasts to be kind of arrogant because it's like, it's basically anybody can put a podcast on, and everybody has a podcast nowadays. We should start a podcast. It's like you have a conversation with your friend and you think, wow, this conversation is so good. People should hear us. It's arrogant, you know? So,
First of all, when you say you don't want to offend anyone, you mean everyone who's listening.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Because these are the people who like podcasts.
Right, exactly.
That's the first thing.
Well, no, it's not the people who listen to podcasts. It's people who have their own podcasts. So I don't know how many podcast creators are listening, but it's like, yeah, man, you really think that people care what you have to say about?
It's a talk radio show that it's basically talk radio without the pressure of being live, and that people can access anytime, wherever they are.
Yeah,
you know? And so it's a cool thing. And plus, you know, you are. I mean, look, you got the Quentin Tarantino hat on. You have the Jurassic Park shirt. You got all the movie stuff. I mean, you are qualified to talk about this stuff. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of this. And, you know, I don't know as much as you do about it, but I certainly have always loved movies. And like I mentioned earlier, we started doing movie recommendations at the end of all of the Due Dissidence episodes. So I thought, why not do a little sort of sister podcast, a sort of little spinoff? We're home anyway. We got nothing the fuck else to do. Our sectors of the economy have not reopened yet.
Right, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy. So we hope you all enjoy the show. We're going to start today just doing, we picked sort of, each of us picked sort of three dissident films. And this was your idea. To do, you know, films that sort of embody the sort of dissident brand. Is that a fair way to say it?
Absolutely, in one way or another, yeah.
All right, so we came up with three, and so
three each, six total,
six movies in total, and I guess we'll start now. Like I said, we're just gonna talk some movie stuff. A little bit of a lighter show than the Due Dissidence show,
right? Yeah, no, this is a lighter show about serious subjects. So we're going to have fun talking about serious subjects. Otherwise, if they don't want to hear that, they could go to the original Dissidents, where it's just like, fuck Biden, everybody, hate everything. Right. And then we could be, Ned. This podcast is like, I love that film that's, I fuck everything, I hate everything. And that's basically what this podcast is in comparison to the other one. All right, so let's get started.
All right, go ahead. You do the honors. What's your first one that you'd like to talk about, Justin?
So I think what I could do is, one of my favorite movies of all time, actually, is a movie called Lenny, which is about a very dissident person. If you never heard of Lenny is about a guy named Lenny Bruce, who was a comedian back in the 1950s. Recently, Lenny Bruce has kind of had a resurgence in, I wouldn't say popularity, but notoriety, from the fact that he is a recurring character on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon Prime. He's like her friend in that. She's a comedian, and he's her friend in that series. But he was a real person. That's more of a kind of a toned-down look at his life. But in 1974, they made an excellent film called Lenny, which is based on a play, actually, that starred Dustin Hoffman. And believe it or not, of all the people to direct it, it was Bob Fosse. Bob Fosse was for many years a very famous dance choreographer, and some say that he revolutionized dance when it came to like Broadway shows and stuff like that. But he started making movies, and for his second film, he made Lenny, which there's no dance. Well, actually, there is dance, some dancing in it regarding one character, but it's not a musical. It's a film. About it's a story. It's a story of Lenny Bruce. It's not the story. It's kind of a more of a collage than a narrative. One of my favorite things about the movie was the tagline, which was he viewed life as a four-letter word. Lenny Bruce was a comedian that he was very what we would call obscene during a time when there were a lot of obscenity laws, and as time went on, it got harder and harder for him to actually say the material that he wanted to say because it was so obscene. If you're thinking about like stuff that George Carlin or Richard Pryor would say, not too long after, just a few years before they became famous for their type of material, Lenny Bruce was doing the same kind of thing, but he was being thrown in jail because of it. And so it ended up ruining his life. He died of a drug overdose. And although some would say it might have been suicide, but his lack of freedom of speech ruined his life, although his actions kind of led to there being changes in regards to obscenity laws. And that's how comedians, for example, today get to say whatever they want. But back in those days, it was life or death for him.
He died quite young, too. I think he was only 41, yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Exactly, and he had lost everything because playing at a club, if you were to say something that they found inappropriate in a club, then the police would say, well, we're going to revoke, I think, well, the liquor authority would say, we're going to revoke that particular club's liquor license, which means that the club can't make money by selling booze if they have Lenny Bruce playing there, which meant that clubs will not hire them, so he couldn't. He wouldn't get hired. He wouldn't get paid. So, and that went on, and it ruined his life. The movie is all about like what is obscene and what is not, because his act was very obscene. It was very dirty, and he used a lot of what we would call bad words. But he kind of said them to kind of depower these words, kind of like we shouldn't be afraid of these words. We should be allowed to say whatever we want. Like I said, the movie kind of poses the question of like, what is obscene and what is not obscene? Are words obscene? Are actions obscene? Like when I was a kid, like, and I wanted to see a movie, I remember my dad, if it was like rated R, my dad would always tell me, well, I'd rather you see the sex then instead of the violence, you know. I think seeing violence is a much more obscene thing than hearing about violence or hearing you know, a bad word or something like that, you know. And that's kind of what the movie is all about. Like I said, it's done kind of like a collage, like a narrative, like a documentary. It begins, the first shot of the movie is this slow fade up on lips. The movie's in black and white, by the way. Stark, grainy, grimy black and white. And the movie starts with lips. And so it's all about, from the very beginning, it's all about words. It's all about what we say. And the movie ends with a photo of Lenny Bruce when they found him dead. And it's the actual photo of Lenny Bruce. And the whole movie, he's asking the question, like, what is obscene? What's so bad about what I'm saying? You know, I didn't do it. I'm just saying it. I'm just talking about it. And at the end of the movie, you know, it asks you, what is really obscene? The last shot of the movie, hate to ruin it for everybody, but the last shot of the movie is a photograph of Lenny Bruce naked and dead. He's died of a drug overdose or possibly killed himself. Is that's obscene? That's more obscene than anything that he said at all in that movie or in his life. And that kind of challenges the audience, confronts the audience with what is really obscene. That's an obscene image, seeing this dead man lying naked there as opposed to anything that he said in his life.
Well, that was very well delivered. You obviously put some thought into this. I'm very impressed.
Thanks.
Yeah. No, I mean, you explained the movie very well. The thing that you did mention that stood out to me about that movie is, even though it's funny that Bob Fosse made that, because it's not a big spectacular production like we kind of think of Bob Fosse, you know, as doing, but it is visual.
Oh yeah,
it's a well shot movie. Yeah, it's not like you would typically think of, like when theater people go and do film, or when somebody who's used to doing a big thing, you know, does something small, it can be a little bit clumsy looking. But no, it's not. It's actually a really, really well made movie. Hoffman is great in it. I thought it was, you know, that was a perfect role for him. And you basically said everything I said. And it's funny because my parents were the same way. Well, my dad didn't really care what I watched, but my mom was much more sensitive about violence than she was about anything else. And she was very protective of, like, what I saw in terms of violence, which is now she thinks it's crazy, because now I get a kick out of, like, the ultra-violent horror films and stuff like that.
Right, but,
like,
yeah.
I used to watch the Michael Keaton Batman basically on a loop as a kid. I was obsessed with that movie, and she would let me watch it. When that came out, I think I was 2 or 3 when that came out, and I was watching it over and over again at, like,
just the opening credits so you could see your name in the credits?
Well, that was the thing. I got a kick out of it that Michael Keaton was Batman, and actually that was really the first, like, I had never really thought of what an actor was. Like, I knew that movies weren't real, but mm-hmm. I never thought about how they were made. Like, I know this is fantasy, but at the same time, it like, I never differentiated between, like, a live action movie and a cartoon. I was like, well, these are all just kind of concocted somehow. So I didn't know what an actor was until Michael Keaton, because he had my last name. And so my mom said, yeah, the actor who plays Batman is named Michael Keaton. I said, what do you mean actor? What's an actor? So she explained to me what, you know, what an actor was. But she worked from home when I was a kid.
In college.
And well, she always worked from home.
Right.
Most of the time. And she would hear on the TV when the scene came on where, you know, Bruce Wayne's mother and father get killed, and she would come into the room and she would just stand in front of the TV and block the screen so I couldn't see that part. And then once that part was over, she would leave and I could watch the rest of it. My first film on my list is really, and I watched this recently just because I knew we were going to
wait a minute, what was
this.
The point of that? We got off on a tangent there, but wait a minute, what was the point of that that note there? I kind of interrupted, and then you went off on a tangent there.
What note? About... Oh, no, because you said that your dad wouldn't want you to see violent movies.
Right. Gotcha.
And I had the same thing.
Okay. That was okay. That was, I got it now.
Okay. Please don't interrupt the show again needlessly.
I'm still trying to get, you know, my bearings here.
Right, I know. Yeah, that's
I'm
right.
New.
Yeah, right. You're rusty. My first movie is Taxi Driver. you know, and this is a bit of an obvious one, but, you know, and by the way, we're not talking about the new Joker film only because that's been talked about to death on podcasts. We actually did an episode, devoted to Joker on our Due Dissidence podcast. So I'm not talking about that, but the second time I watched Taxi Driver, well, it's not the second time. I've seen it probably about 4 or 5 times. But the most recent time I watched it was the first time since the Joker movie came out. And I realized just how similar they are, not just in terms of tone, but in terms of theme. And Taxi Driver is just a perfect little movie. Like, it really is. I don't know where that stands for you in, like, the Scorsese filmography, but that's always been my favorite of his films, and it still is. I mean, I watched that movie. It's just so well done. It's amazingly well written. The lead performance, obviously, is just one of a kind. And there's so much interesting stuff going on in that movie. It's basically a running interior monologue about a character who is just completely lost in a world that, you know, just completely shuns him in the way that the Joker character gets completely shunned by the world, to the point where he can't even process how he rebels against it. That's what's so interesting about that movie, is that the forces of, like, social I would say isolation, alienation, combined with like a specific background, right? He was a Marine, he's a Vietnam veteran. You know, combined with the a sort of landscape, the sort of urban wasteland that was New York City in the 1970s, like Travis Bickle is just so ill-equipped to not only function in this world, but to rebel against it in a way that makes real sense. And that's what's so interesting to me with that movie. You watched it recently. What do you think of Taxi Driver?
I love Taxi Driver. I think in terms of the Scorsese oeuvre, did I say that right?
Oeuvre. Yeah, that's
oeuvre. Yeah,
that's
good enough. That's close enough. Yeah, no, it's probably on the lesser. I tend to like if you were like measuring Scorsese films by like speed, with like Irishman at the slowest, and then like a half a click more is Taxi Driver. I tend to more enjoy the more frenetically paced films, like a Goodfellas or a Casino.
Yeah, or Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah,
or Wolf of Wall Street. Those more frenetically edited movies where it's like boom, boom, boom. I like those. But Taxi Driver is great. And rewatching it, honestly, I don't want to get into a whole big comparison here, but. Watching Taxi Driver for the first time after seeing Joker, which, by the way, I'm in. I have a small cameo. I'm an extra in Joker. No big deal. Anyways, how much of an attempted imitation of Taxi Driver that movie is. And, like, it's really not as good. I mean, it really is not as... It's kind of... I find much more realism in Taxi Driver than I do Joker. And Joker, obviously, they're taking some of these kind of comic book archetypes. So, yeah, I know it's not going to be, like, exactly the same. But you feel more for the character, I feel, in Taxi Driver. I think it's more manufactured in Joker than it is in Taxi Driver. But Taxi Driver is fantastic. Just the look of it, the sound of it. New York City was a very weird place in the 1970s. At the time when the movie was made, I believe New York City was broke, actually. And they filmed in areas of the Upper West Side that were abandoned because people fled the city. They went out to the suburbs. And it's such a great portrayal of a man, of a city, at a moment in time. And it's just, of course, one of the all-time great performances. And I also love Albert Brooks in that movie as well.
Yeah, Brooks is great. I mean, the whole cast is great. De Niro, obviously, fantastic in the lead role. I mean, I can't think of a movie that is as reliant on the lead performance as that film. Like, that's a film where you need a home run lead role. You know, you need an actor who can carry that. And Sybil Shepherd is great. I think as much as I'm not a huge Harvey Keitel fan, he's very good in it. Jodie Foster. I love Albert Brooks. I'm a huge fan of Albert Brooks. I thought he was good in that movie too. And the thing about Taxi Driver is it's funny. Like, because there's an innocence about Travis Bickle too, right? He ends up, you know, being this like vigilante, right, who goes and saves the day at the end for this underage girl who's obviously being pimped out by a very brutal, you know, pimp.
Him, for lack of a better word.
For lack of a better word. But he starts out, he's just this innocent guy who doesn't understand the world he lives in. Like, he takes the girl to a porno theater on the first date, and she gets obviously furious at him. He says, well, I didn't know you didn't like these kinds of movies. Come on, what? Talk to me. He sends her flowers afterwards. He tries to, you know, make up for it. And then she shuns him again, and that's when he gets really angry and he storms the office. But the... was it Chuck Palahniuk or Charles Palahniuk? I mean,
Charles Palahniuk. Yeah. It is. Technically is both.
Yeah, it could be both. The Charles Palahniuk campaign is such an interesting backdrop for that movie because it really drives home how this sort of like social isolation and, you know, a bit of mental illness in there too really undermines people's ability to like channel these negative feelings they have in like productive kinds of ways. Like from what we know about Palantine, we don't know what party he's in, right? But we get a sense that he's a fairly good candidate, right? Like he has a multiracial audience at his rallies. You know, his slogan is, you know, we are the people. He talks about, you know, expanding a sort of social welfare program. He talks about how, you know, the people got screwed with the Vietnam War. He talks about how we're victims of corruption, of concentrated wealth at the top. You know, he seems like a fairly good candidate. And it makes Travis Bickle, among other things, look like this kind of reactionary, kind of right-wing figure almost. Like when he has lunch with Jodie Foster, who is a 12-and-a-half-year-old prostitute, you know, she tells him, like, you know, she says he's a nerd, you know, he's a square. She says, haven't you ever heard of women's lib? Right? So he's portrayed as this, like, old-school, almost, like, traditional conservative character who ends up rebelling against this, you know, system. And more explicitly, you know, he shows up at the rally, you know, with the aims to kill Palantine. And one of my favorite scenes in the movie is towards the beginning where he has Palantine in the cab. That's such a fantastic scene. And it's such a funny scene, too. Like, he says, oh, you're good. You know, I tell everybody to vote for you. And they're like, oh, really? You know, and he asks him, you know, to some version of, like, why is that? He says, well, you know really know. I don't really follow politics that close.
He says, no, he, like, he openly mentions that I don't even know what any of your policies, what his policies right, are. I think he's talking to Cybill Shepherd's. Whatever it is, good, I'm sure.
Oh, well, right, because he wants her to go have coffee with him, right? Like, he's just trying to get the girl.
He doesn't know anything about him.
Doesn't know anything. And then when Palantine says, you know, what bugs you? He goes from this very innocent, polite fanboy, you know, to, well, you know, I think whoever the president is, you ought to clean up this city because there's a lot of filth and scum in the city. Says, whoever the president is, you just flush it all down the fucking toilet, you know? And the candidate has no idea what to make of this guy. But then he shakes his hand and he says, you're a good man, sir. I'm sure you'll win. You know, there's such a chaos about him. And the fact that it doesn't quite make sense what he's actually rebelling against, what, you know, actually drives him. We sense he has this very strict moral code, which probably comes from being, you know, a veteran and stuff like that. But he is a confused, alone, mentally troubled person in a world that doesn't really care about him. Yeah. And it's the same thing in Joker. See, the thing about Joker is Joker was just a little more on the nose. Like, looking at Joker, it's more on the nose. And it's not a mystery why. Because Joker is the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Joker's a, you know, DC Universe movie. It's mass entertainment. If they released Joker today without calling it Joker, just did it like in, like, a small sort of character study, like Taxi Driver is, no one would see it. You probably couldn't even get it made. And so I love Taxi Driver.
A movie that I would love to make, and I think that Joker was a lot of influenced on it, is I would love to make a movie about Bernard Goetz. I think that, like Taxi Driver, that's a similar kind of great New York story, and Joker is much influenced by that, I think, as well.
You have a lot of these ideas, you know. You published a photo on Facebook the other day of all your movie ideas from when you were a teenager.
Like, Yeah.
That was probably when we first got to be friends.
Yeah. I know. Taxi Driver is great. And I like that last shot of the movie, where he readjusts the you think maybe he sees something, he adjusts the
mirror,
the rearview mirror, and it's like, after all that, he becomes kind of like a hero. It's like, there could be another episode of this, there could be, you know, something else could happen. It's almost like, I think I even heard one time that That could be almost like the start of the cycle again. The movie starts all over again after that shot.
Well,
like,
because there's an endless... I mean, when you think about it, it could be. I mean, one of the points of the movie is that, you know, he's navigating this little lifeboat through a sea of filth and scum and garbage and trash. I mean, he's always ranting about the lowlifes, right, that make up the city, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what they were getting at. And you know, the other thing about Taxi Driver is... As dark as it is, it's actually not that violent until the very end. I mean, there's almost no violence in the movie until the very end. There's talk of violence, right? There's it's violent, kind of vicious, grimy, nasty dialogue, very sexually explicit talk about really obscene acts of violence. You know, the scene where they're talking about, you know, hey, did you hear this guy got half his ear cut off uptown, you know, by one of these crazy fuckers, you know, like there's all this really obscene talk. But not an explosion of physical violence until the very end. And it has a happy ending. Now, there are theories that that ending is actually sort of like a fantasy and that he actually does die in the brothel. Yeah. But either way, he saves the girl, right? It's like this like fairy tale ending where he storms the palace and saves the princess. And so it's just wonderful. It's great. And the one other scene that I find funny in there is the talk that he has with the wizard. I'm blanking on the actor who plays the wizard.
Peter Boyle.
Yes. I can never fucking keep that name in my head, no matter what. Where he talks about, you know, you are who you are, right? You take a job and that job becomes who you are. And he says, you know, we're all fucked in the end anyway. You know, it doesn't matter. You're young. Go be you. It doesn't matter. We're all fucked anyway. And then the very next scene is when he goes in, he buys the gun. Right. It's almost like that pep talk led him. It's very similar to the Joker movie where his coworker gives him the gun and kind of leads him down this very like destructive path. Right. That's another similarity. Right. It's like coworker. He kind of puts his faith in, ends up. I mean, in this case, it's more inadvertent. But ends up sort of, you know, bringing him to a certain like realization about himself, that really changes the course of his life. And you can't even say whether it's for the better or for the worse, because in this movie, you know, there is that happy ending.
That's right.
All right, Justin, what's your second one?
I think, going off of, Taxi Driver, I would like to talk kind of like another movie that kind of gets lumped in to that category is I was trying to think of what Oliver Stone movie I would want to talk about, because all his movies are dissident in one way or another. I was saying a little bit about Born on the 4th of July, which is kind of like a personal favorite Oliver Stone movie, but I think the movie that embodies dissidence in not only its story but also in its storytelling is Natural Born Killers from 1993. I want to say.
I think that was actually 94, yeah.
94. So Natural Born Killers actually starred as a screenplay by Quentin Tarantino that he wrote, that he was going to make, that was like a more of like a straightforward kind of like action movie. And he sold it before he got famous. And these two, I read a whole, about 10 years ago, I read a book called Killer Instinct, which was about the making of Natural Born Killers. And it's a frenetic movie, and it was a frenetic shoot. And these two producers had optioned the script from him before he was famous. And then Reservoir Dogs came out, and they're like, we have this script by Quentin Tarantino. And they sold it to Warner Brothers. And then Oliver Stone got attracted to it and kind of rewrote it. And so when you watch the movie, it says story by Quentin Tarantino. I think they have a lot of his dialogue in it and some isn't, or maybe they took it. I forget which one it is. But they basically kind of restructured the story, not to be just a kind of a straightforward action movie, but to be more reflective of the media during that time. That's what Oliver Stone was really interested in, which, of course, pissed off Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, there's little social commentary in the Tarantino script. I've actually read the Quentin Tarantino script of that movie. It's fantastic, but it's totally different.
And it's more from the Robert Downey Jr. perspective, right? The Wayne Gale character?
You know, I read it so long ago, I couldn't tell you what perspective it was in, but there was definitely more of that character in it.
Right. And so the movie itself, like I said, it's dissonant in its storytelling. It was a frenetic shoot. No one was getting along on that shoot. They had a real-life prison riot during a prison riot shoot scene.
Oh, yeah.
They were on location scouting. They took mushrooms, and they started freaking out during the location scout. And people got divorced because of that movie, the cinematographer and Oliver Stone. It was a hellish shoot. I think every shoot with Oliver Stone is hellish, but that was particularly hellish. And in terms of the storytelling, it's like a lot of people would call this movie like the biggest student film ever made, or just the largest mainstream experimental film, because they have so many jump cuts. I think a normal movie has like 600 jump cuts. It's 600 cuts. This has 3,000. It was about a year editing process, and so there are jump cuts, there are sequences of animation. He used different film stocks. There's black and white, there's color. There's a sequence that's in a sitcom fashion. There's non-linear editing. There is internal editing, which is almost like, you know, it's like you see like what the characters are thinking while they're saying, while you're hearing it saying. You got to watch it to really understand it. But it's a crazy, crazy edited film. And it's a commentary on the media, and it was coming at a time when O.J. Simpson, that trial was going on, and that was televised live, and America became obsessed with the O.J. Simpson trial and other trials of the period, like I think like the Menendez brothers and stuff like that.
Well, the very end, right before they do the credits, is a montage that's interspliced with real life, sort of like sensationalist, violent media.
Yeah.
Including OJ. Love that, there's a shot of OJ in there too.
And I love that scene because Oliver Stone always likes to kind of hit people on the head with stuff. And like at the end of the movie, he kind of like shows you what he just showed you. Like, this is what the movie was about. But when he shows OJ Simpson and then his brothers, I think Tanya Harding as well, because that was going on at the same time. But the movie is about a pair of serial killers, Mickey and Mallory, Woody Harrelson and Juliet Lewis. Who go on a killing spree across the country, and the media becomes obsessed with them. And it is was, of course, reflective of the day, because America, through television, kind of became obsessed with murder and the media, and it's gotten even worse today. Court TV started around the same time, and constantly seeing making narratives out of real-life murder became very, very popular. And now today, there is even strangely kind of just this true crime fascination that people had. And in the United States, anyways, it really started with that. It's one of those movies that is very violent without, like, glorifying violence. It's one of those movies. Although a lot of people feel that it kind of like may have led to real life crimes.
Well, there was one series, there was one killing that I think was attributed to that movie, I recall. Yeah. Whether it glorifies violence or not, I'm not sure. You know, I don't love the movie. It is an effective movie, and it's a mean movie. I mean, it is a really mean, nasty movie, I think. And that's part of what makes it powerful. That's part of what makes the violence work. One of the most disturbing sequences in any movie I've ever seen is that sitcom segment called Mallory's World, where Rodney Dangerfield...
Wrong.
What?
I Love Mallory.
It wasn't called Mallory's World?
No, it's a takeoff on I Love Lucy.
Oh, okay. I thought that was called Mallory's
Wrong.
World. All right. But anyway, that is a shockingly vile and very upsetting sequence, which perfect casting Rodney Dangerfield as her father, as this big oafish guy who basically rapes her. I mean, it's a story. It basically takes her childhood as being, you know, just like viciously, you know, sexually mistreated by her father, when her mom knew about it the whole time, and stylizes it as this sitcom with a laugh track, and you could tell like the camera lenses, it looks like an actual sitcom. Just really unbelievably mean, cruel stuff, like when she says, you know, like the mother says to the father, you know, you haven't touched me in 15 years, And he says, well, how do you think this guy got here? You know, she has like a younger brother. Yeah. And she's like, well, you came home drunk and you thought you were in Mallory's room. Like, really nasty stuff. But the decision to do that as a sitcom, like I said, it just rubs everything in the audience's face. It's such a bombastic, confrontational movie. And it is effective. I don't love it. Well, I think the Tarantino script is better than the movie version. But it is effective.
Well, I love that sequence just because up until that point, the media kind of portrayed a certain way of life that, you know, wasn't true for a lot of people.
Well, that's
like,
the point
you know,
of it, yeah.
And that of course, that's just such a great metaphor to how to portray real realism that happens in everyday life.
And you couldn't cast it any better. I mean,
yeah.
To have Rodney Dangerfield play that part, it was just, I mean, it really, like I said, made it a very effective, very upsetting sequence.
I loved it because and even now, like I said, I think it's even more reflective now of the way that things are. Things have gotten worse because of social media and the fact that, like, people, you know, I'm not going to obviously, you know, hurt the audience, but people like to be on social media. They like to put themselves on Instagram and Snapchat and stuff like that. You're kind of making your life media. We are living through media these days. And so our obsession with media has only gotten worse. I don't know. I think that movie is more relevant than ever.
Somewhat. You know, the thing about it is back then, because there wasn't so much media out there, it kind of made it more powerful, right? Because it was easier to get absorbed by this because this is all that was on offer, right? It seemed like everywhere you looked was either a courtroom TV show or an actual trial with the OJ case, right? Whereas here, people have more options, right? There's, you know, they don't have to get sucked into that if they don't want to, but a lot of people want to. I mean, Netflix, you know, it's like there's like 5 true crime miniseries a year that, you know, everybody starts talking about on Netflix. Podcasts, true crime podcasts are like the big craze. We should have started one of
those.
That's
the next one.
Yeah.
Dissident.
Dissident True Crime.
Murder Club.
Dissident Murder Mystery Theater.
Yeah.
Okay, so my second pick is a bit of a nicer movie, and it's a movie that I really loved by another, we could say, a dissident person. Sean Penn
absolutely
directed this movie. It's called Into the Wild. I absolutely loved Into the Wild when it came out. It's based on a book by John Krakauer about Christopher McCandless. It's based on a true story of a kid who basically graduated college and decided he didn't want to be a part of the world anymore. He just wanted to run away and live in the woods. And it's this odyssey of people he meets on the way. Just beautiful cinematography. Really, you could tell it was made by a guy who has a reverence for the natural world. You could tell it was made by a guy who felt a special kinship to this main character. And I think a lot of people do. I know I certainly have. I mean, there's woods in back of my house. Every once in a while, I think, man, wouldn't it be nice to just live out there instead of having to deal with all this crap?
I want
to
walk out. I want to walk out there.
just climb the fence and go away. I mean, I would take my family with me, of course.
We have a friend that I'm not going to mention his name, but he always used to talk about how he just wanted to go out into the woods and build a house and never come back.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, I sympathize with that. A part of me always has, and I think there's a part of a lot of people that have, and that's why I think this movie resonated with me so much. The other thing that I loved about the movie and loved about this character is that he has a contempt for society. He has a contempt for, like, societal conventions, but he has a real love for people. Right, he's not anti-human. He gets along great with all these people he meets along the way. It's got a great cast too of like supporting actors: Vince Vaughn, Hal Holbrook. A great little performance by a very young Kristen Stewart, actually, who's in that movie probably for about 20 minutes. And he just expresses such love for people. It's not that he's like this reclusive, like, you know, ne'er-do-well, what's the word? Malcontent. He's really not. He just doesn't feel he has a place in the world that people have created for him. And he just feels this, you know, need to say, fuck it all, I'm going out. And it's a great little odyssey of a movie. I thought it was super well done. Emil Hirsch is fantastic in it. It was a great breakout role for him. And I think the movie kind of got overlooked in the year it came out, just because it came out in 2007, which I think if you look back, I think it's pretty undeniable that, like,
oh, it's a great year.
That was the best year of this century so far for films. I mean, no doubt. You had There Will Be Blood, which a lot of people think of as the best film to be made in the 2000s.
Yeah.
No Country for Old Men, another masterpiece, which won the Oscar that year. Then you had Once, the little, you know, indie musical, which took off and became the massive hit and a Broadway play based on it and stuff. Then you had all these other kinds of films that were perhaps not quite on that level, but still really amazingly good. There was a movie with Philip Seymour Hoffman called The Savages that came out that year. That was a great movie. Michael Clayton was quite good. You had American Gangster that year. You had Ang Lee do his follow-up to Brokeback Mountain that year, which is a great movie called Lust Caution, which didn't get a lot of recognition because it had the combination of being subtitled and had an NC-17 rating, so that can kill your box office pretty quick.
Yeah.
But you just had amazing films. Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is a cool little foreign film, that came out that year too. It was such a great year, and so I think Into the Wild kind of got lost. But then there was a period after it where I think it would have really done quite well if it came out either a little before it did or a little after it did, because I love that movie.
Yeah, I saw it when it first came out. I remember enjoying it. I don't remember much else besides that, but I do remember enjoying it. So,
all right. Well, we kept that quick.
Yeah.
All right.
Good job.
All right. Last ones.
So for my final film is a movie called The Truman Show, which for me anyways, The Truman Show is an important movie for me because, believe it or not, it kind of changed my movie-going path. Because when I was a kid, like, the two types of movies that I liked were, you know, animated kids' movies and comedies. And usually, mostly, comedies with Jim Carrey. And Jim Carrey's career kind of took a change when he decided to do this movie. And I went to see this movie because Jim Carrey was in it. And that was, like, my first adult movie. And that was a big transitional movie to me because before that I was seeing these kind of silly films and kid movies. And that was the first, like, adult movie that I went to the movies to see. And that's like, oh, this is cinema. I'll say it like that. I was like, oh, wow, this is a real movie. And it's such an outstanding film. Obviously, you probably know what it's about. It's about a guy who realizes that his whole life is a TV show. And on the surface, you could say that, you know, it's a movie that's about, like, exploitation or voyeurism, how we're obsessed with, like, watching other people, and kind of a precursor to the whole reality TV craze that would come, like, a few years later.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But more so than that, it's about structure versus free will and breaking free. And so the movie, the TV show, The Truman Show, is directed by a character played by Ed Harris named Kristoff, of course. So he's kind of like God, I guess you could say, the aptly named Kristoff. And he's creating this world for Truman. And when it comes to, I don't want to really get into religion here, but religion teaches you that, at least what I was kind of raised with, is that and my understanding is that God has a plan for all of us. And that's what we're led to believe. And sequence of events happen to us according to God's will or God's plan. Almost kind of like a TV show where a writer or director is writing this TV show and it's going to go all the way to plan the way he wants it. Kind of like supposedly God. God has his plan for all of us. But what the Truman Show says is that there's free will involved. Truman has no free will. He's contingent to whatever the world is that Christoph, the director, has created for him. And so he creates this kind of society, this world where it's controlled. And Truman is a person who wants to do things that he can't do. He's not he can't do. Because he's kind of trapped in this TV world unbeknownst to him. He wants to travel. He wants to go on adventures. I think he wants to go to Fiji. I think that's his big thing.
But don't they create this artificial plot where they say that, like, his father died in a boating accident, so he's afraid of the water or something like that?
Right. Yeah, he's afraid of the water, but he's still there. They create all these things to keep him there, so he cannot leave. He cannot go off and, you know, want to do what he wants, because obviously he can't, because he's technically in a huge soundstage. But he, like, tries to get on a plane, and first of all, there's like a photo of like lightning striking the plane, and there's like it says it could happen. It happens a lot, and there's like no tickets to Fiji anytime soon. He tries to get on a bus to go somewhere, and of course, the driver of the bus is an actor. Like, they don't know how to drive the bus, so right. He doesn't go anywhere. And so it's that whole thing about, like, you know, society kind of. There's kind of like a lifestyle that, like, we're supposed to live. That's the real way that we're supposed to live, abiding by society's rules. And this is kind of like about breaking free of that. The last shot of the movie is, you know, he finds a door and Christoph appeals to him not to leave. And he decides to anyways. He opens the door and the door is black. And it's kind of like the unknown, because unlike a TV show, real life, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's what the next step is for Truman. He doesn't know what's going to happen to him. His life will no longer be a TV show. It won't be planned out by anyone. Much some would say that life really is. It's not part of God's plan. If it was part of God's plan, a lot of people would really be probably upset, especially right now what we're going through. A lot of people would be like, wow, this is somebody's plan? Like, this is supposed to happen to me? These awful, horrible things are supposed to happen to me? This says that, you know, you can do whatever you want, and anything can happen to you, and it's not because of anything. It's not because of any reason. It just happens. And so he goes off into the unknown to embrace that. And besides that, it's just such a clever movie, cleverly shot, amazing performances. Jim Carrey should have gotten an Oscar nomination, should have won. Like I said, big landmark movie, I think, for me. Anyways, I don't know how you think.
I love the Truman Show. As far as Jim Carrey getting an Oscar for that, that was a particularly strong year. That was 1998, so you had Edward Norton in American History X.
Oh, yeah,
you also had Roberto Benigni win for Life is Beautiful, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, if not my favorite movie of all time. That's an absolutely beautiful film. That actually could have been on this list, too, now that I think of it. I'm kind of mad that I didn't put it on.
Dissident in a comedic way.
That's just an absolutely extraordinary movie.
Watched it recently too, actually.
Oh, it's very just good. Absolutely yeah. Fantastic. I mean, the last like 10 minutes of that movie are just like perfection. I mean, the way it ends and resolves and everything is just, it's so moving and haunting and sad, and mm-hmm. but in a way it's in keeping with the sort of slapstick nature of the movie. That's an absolute masterpiece. Anyway, back to the Truman Show. First of all, casting Jim Carrey in that movie, the movie made like $260 million at the box office. It was a huge hit. And, you know, I always feel like there's a great opportunity when you have actors who have done one kind of thing their whole career to sort of, if you can cast them in the first thing that gets them to step outside their comfort zone and they do well, it always does well for the movie. Punch Drunk Love, same thing. P.T. Anderson cast Adam Sandler in that movie. He went from being this goofy sort of, you know, almost like you know, set aside sort of SNL actor to being taken very, very seriously. Jim Carrey actually was the perfect guy for that role, too. I mean, it happened to be really well cast. It wasn't just a good business movie. He actually does really well. And I love the little clever flourishes in the movie. Like, I love how they get the advertisements in. Like, because every other character but Truman is in on the game, obviously. Right. So, like, you know, Laura Linney at one point, she privileges some, like, cereal box or whatever and reads advertising for that product. Yeah, so it's a very, very inventive and cool movie. That's a good pick. All right, so my last pick is Fight Club. And I thought of Fight Club. I had seen Fight Club a few times, and I watched it again recently. And one of the things that I noticed about Fight Club that's so cool, and one of the things that makes it so transgressive and so subversive, is the fact that it's really not a brilliant movie. Like, Fight Club is not genius. And I feel like that's part of the whole trick of the film, is to kind of trick viewers and critics into thinking it's trying to be actually a lot more than it is. Because what most people's critiques of Fight Club are is that it's kind of simple-minded and stupid. It's toxic masculinity, right? It's a guy who creates, spoiler alert, we put Fight Club at the end in case anybody hasn't seen it, that Tyler Durden, the Brad Pitt character, and Edward Norton, the narrator character, are the same person. So it's this pathetic, like, middle-class, middle-aged, well, not middle-aged, he's actually quite young, but just this boring sort of white-collar professional who lives in a condo that he stocks with IKEA furniture and is obsessed with all of his, like, material goods. This is, like, if that guy were to create in his mind a revolutionary, Tyler Durden is who he would create. Just this kind of very simple, sort of pugnacious, violent, visceral, kind of dope. Like, they're like the plan is so stupid that they hatch, right? We're going to create underground fight clubs. Men are going to be able to get their, you know, rocks off by beating the shit out of each other. And then we're going to blow up the six major credit card headquarters to basically, you know, crash capitalism and, you know, knock out everybody's debts. And then the world will start over in this sort of anarchist vision. Like, it's bonkers. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. And people think of that as, like, that's people's critique of the movie. But what you have to remember is the whole movie is being told to you by this pathetic, kind of weak, dweeby narrator. And so the whole film is told from that perspective. And I think it's one, almost like Taxi Driver, not quite the same, obviously, but it's a way of just, like, the impotence of so many people's desire to change the world, right? The world always wins because so many people who have these grand plans just aren't equipped to deal with it in a productive way. And so the only way this fucking asshole can think to improve himself is first to go to, like, cancer support group meetings, even though he doesn't have cancer, just to get this sort of, like, emotional release by being around people with real problems. And then when that falls apart because a girl shows up who's doing the same thing and kind of exposes him to himself in a way that he's uncomfortable with, the second way he goes about it is creating these underground fight clubs and then comes up with this harebrained scheme to overthrow the system by blowing up a bunch of buildings. And so it's a clever trick on its own audience, it's on its own critics, and you could even see the sort of meta component of that. You could see the movie almost suggests that it's edited by Tyler Durden. Because he works as a film editor. There's that scene towards the beginning where he intercuts the, like, porno clips. Right. But he edits in these, like, porno clips into these family movies. And the very last, one of the last frames of the movie, like, a dick flashes on the screen.
Right,
this,
yeah.
Like, this was all part of a trick. This was all part of the narrator's game on you. It's a really clever film in that way that is sort of intentionally, I think, not that brilliant. I think in a way that's sort of the charm of it. And it's very, very funny. I mean, it really is a dark comedy. And I think Edward Norton is great in it. I think Brad Pitt is great in it. I think Helena Bonham Carter is fantastic. And they really do a great job of doing the split personality thing. Like, once you watch it back, knowing the big twist, which is that Brad Pitt is basically a creation of the narrator, you really notice just how cleverly they set that up without you ever really catching on. And they put it, like, right in front of your face at certain times. Like, the whole thing where, like, when the narrator says, you know, Tyler and Marla were never in the same room unless they were humping. Like, right? Like, when he's sexual with her, he's the other guy. And every other scene, he is who he is. And then when she starts acting like he's being weird, we don't even pick up on that. But when you watch it again, you're like, wait a minute, you're my lover, and now you're acting like you don't know me, because outside the bedroom, he's this different person. And just the way all that stuff was shot and edited and executed, I mean, Fincher is a master of like technical filmmaking and stuff like that, so that makes sense. But it's just such a cool, fun, and very, like I said, darkly funny movie.
Yeah, I know. I just watched it in anticipation for the podcast, and I had seen it before. I think I saw it at your apartment, and I forget at the time if I knew the twist. But going into this time, first of all, I liked it a lot much better than the first time I saw it. And I knew the twist. I was kind of looking for the way they set that up in the movie. Like, there are certain, like, no one, like, in their scenes when there are other people, like, no one actually is directing any conversation towards Brad Pitt's character. They're all talking to
right. They Edward never Norton. Engage other people in the same conversation. One is always watching the other. Yeah.
There's no shots from over what we call an over the in the biz. We call an over the shoulder shot from behind Brad Pitt, because that suggests that the person is there. So it's always not a. It's always kind of like a POV. An Edward Norton's character is kind of POV, or an over the shoulder shot of Edward Norton's character looking at Tyler Durden.
Or the take in the kitchen of the ramshackled house where, like, you know, Edward Norton and Marla will be in the same shot, and then, you know, she'll leave, and then Brad Pitt will come down and he'll talk to Edward Norton. It's like, he's an interior monologue who comes down the stairs and leaves, and then when she comes in, he's gone. Yeah.
And I usually don't like that. I think that I've seen that kind of trope in other movies. I think that even came before Fight Club, where at the end it's like, it was a split personality this whole time. I was the same person the whole time. I always felt that's kind of like a cop-out, but it really is successful in this film, more so than any other film I've ever seen. And I love Fincher's style. I like when, and this is probably with all his movies, probably his earlier movies, is that when the movie starts, the kind of the grubbiness of like the image, it's like it already starts like every world of his, it's the real world, but we're already in hell, you know. It's terrible. The color of the walls are kind of like which they got to do something, I think, in the chemical processing, because that movie was shot on film. Just the way the grubbiness of the movie, he just is able with color and with light, is just able just to create these just grungy worlds. And it's gritty world. Oh, it's fantastic.
It's grungy and gritty, but it's also slick. Like, it's clean. It's like professionally done. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
It's very precise, you know? And so there's like a stylistic sort of juxtaposition there. I think the reason why that twist works as well as it does in this, and why it actually is better on repeat viewing despite knowing the big reveal, is because there's more like meat on the bones from like a thematic standpoint. Like, when you watch The Sixth Sense again, it's kind of boring because
and also it doesn't make any sense.
Well, also there's logical gaps, which I don't fault The Sixth Sense for that. The whole movie was sort of a sleight of hand sort of trick, you know, but that's the point. That's all it really is. And so when you watch it again, it's kind of boring. Whereas this, there's still all these other things to think about. You know, this like apocalyptic vision that's born of this guy who, and once again, they even directly mock the theme of the movie. Like, it's self-deprecating in a pretty obvious way. Like that, like it's almost really in like a slapstick way. Like when this scene, and again, talk about like dark humor, where Bob dies. Bob is the cancer survivor, right? Who has the, you know, tits.
Meatloaf.
Meatloaf. They come back and he's been shot in the head, and they said, you know, our homework assignment, because Tyler at the end of every Fight Club meeting gives the people homework assignments, things to do. You have to start a fight and lose is one of them. And then there's that great slapstick sequence where the guys start, you know, squirting people with hoses and trying to get their ass kicked, right? But the one homework assignment that they were out on, it says we had two assignments. We had to destroy a piece of corporate art and vandalize a franchise coffee shop. And they said, we thought we could kill two birds with one stone by detonating this, like, C4 or whatever the fuck it was, under, like, that big brass sculpture in that courtyard outside the office building. And the plan was they were going to blow that up and then have the ball roll through the window of one of the franchise coffee shops that was in the building. Like I said, that's almost self-right. That's, that, like I said, it's making fun of itself there. Like, oh, we killed two birds at one stone. Why? Why couldn't you just use one piece of explosive for one and one for the other? Like, it's a stupid idea to the point where it's funny. And oh, by the way, you're a New York tour guide. That was made a couple years before 9/11. So obviously the image of those buildings just imploding at the end is eerie watching it again. But also that piece of corporate art.
Yeah.
Looks eerily ball. Like the sphere, which is the bronze statue that was between the
Koenig sphere.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Right?
The Koenig sphere.
Oh, okay, right. I'm sorry, you give the full name. And on 9/11, the Twin Towers collapsed onto it, and it was recovered in surprisingly good shape, considering what it had been through, and it's actually displayed now in the memorial grounds, or right above it, right? Isn't it on the overpass or something like that?
Yeah.
But I thought that was eerie about it.
I know. I noticed that too when I was watching it. But I don't think they say the name of the city, but that was definitely not New York.
It's a nameless city. They don't get into what it is, and they don't. And the narrator has no name. He's just called the narrator. Which is another hint that there's some sort of multiple personality going on, because nobody ever refers to the Norton character by his name, because he has no name. And the fact that also this guy is such a dweeb that when he realizes that he's kind of lost his mind, like once he realizes, oh, I've created this like nationwide cult, because there start becoming fight clubs in all different cities, right? Every city has its own chapter of this fight club, and it becomes Project Mayhem, which is like, you know, that's the big terrorist group that's going to, you know, overthrow consumerism and, you know, all that stuff. Once he realizes how crazy he's gone, he doesn't have any other way to, like I said, channel his like dissatisfaction with his life and the world around him. He's just at that point, he becomes a total like chicken. She's like, oh, wait a minute. Stop everything. Call it off. Right, I'll go back to my normal life. Like, I'll take my shitty job back that I hate. That's what caused all this shit in the first place, is that I was going crazy at my boring life, was driving me to the point where I couldn't sleep. I couldn't feel anything. Once he realizes he's gone nuts, he's like, never mind. Right? He calls the whole thing off.
Yeah.
And at that point, it's too late. Like, the guy's just a total weakling. He's a total pussy. He's a total nobody. And the movie is told from the perspective of a total nobody. Like, this is what that kind of loser's view of a revolution would look like. And I think that makes it all the more subversive and all the more sort of challenging, because it's not even being told from an omniscient narrator. It's being told by a very unreliable narrator, right? Like, the most unreliable narrator that could possibly be. He literally doesn't even know who he is.
Yeah, no, it's excellent. Excellent film.
All right. Well, I guess that's been our first episode. How do you think that went? I think that went pretty good.
I think it went good.
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully people will enjoy that. Like I said, just a little spin-off project that we figured we would do. We're going to have our own. But by the time we put this up, I don't know. We're recording this in early June. We'll probably have this up sometime, you know, before the end of the month. But whenever we launch, this will be the first episode. Like I said, this we have published on the Do Dissidents feed. We'll have our own feed, so you could subscribe to this podcast on any podcast player. Might take a week or two to get approved on all of them, but we'll be on iTunes fairly quickly. We'll be on SoundCloud. We'll use that as the host. I don't even know what we'll use as our host for this one. But you could subscribe to it, and we'll get a Facebook page and all that shit set up, and a YouTube channel to subscribe to that. So, Justin?
Wait, I'm waving to you as if you're watching the YouTube channel.
Yes, right, if you're seeing this on video, you'll see Justin waving. If not, you'll just hear me saying thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time.